KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
It was a great relief for about 5 minutes. And then my negative Nancy mind goes to, oh no, now what?
The U.S. and China agreed to lower their triple-digit
tariff. Then this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. As President Trump tries to end the war in Ukraine, Poland tries to prevent a Russian invasion.
We have developed a strategy to counter any kind of mass land grab or mass land invasion or incursion that would occur.
Also, our new series, Here to Help, begins. Stories of people across the U.S. who volunteer.
It feels great to kind of open up your social circles to include people who aren't from your immediate family and closest friends.
And President Trump signs a new executive order that tries to lower drug prices.
Many in the drug industry oppose his approach.
First, this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. President Donald Trump has begun a week-long trip to the Middle East with stops planned in Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and the United Arab Emirates. Earlier today, he signed a sweeping executive order setting a 30-day deadline for drug companies to lower the cost of prescription drugs in the U.S. or face new limits over what the government will pay. Trump says if no deal is reached, costs fall to the lowest price paid by other countries.
It's called most favored nation. We are going to pay the lowest price there is in the world. We will get whoever is paying the lowest price. That's the price that we're going to get. So remember that. So we're no longer paying 10 times more than another country.
The nation's pharmaceutical lobby quickly labeled the president's order a bad deal for U.S. customers. Drug makers argue threats to their profits will affect research on new medicines. House Republicans are hoping to finish crafting their massive spending bill this week. As NPR's Elena Mora reports, the remaining three committees are set to mark up and advance their portions of the bill, but some internal divisions remain.
The House Energy and Commerce Committee, the Ways and Means Committee, and the Committee on Agriculture will each meet tomorrow. GOP leaders must find a way to meet demands for deep spending cuts while also working to appease members who want to protect costly programs and tax incentives. One example is over SALT, state and local property taxes. Members in competitive New York, New Jersey, and California districts say their support for the bill is tied to a higher cap for SALT deductions. It's crucial for GOP leaders to get these folks on board. Republicans hold a slim majority in the House, and they'll need nearly full party approval to get the bill passed. Elena Moore, NPR News.
U.S. Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy says he's racing to upgrade decades-old technology that's causing repeated meltdowns and delaying hundreds of flights at Newark Liberty International Airport in recent weeks. Ramsey Khalife of member station WNYC reports.
The terminals used to manage flights in and out of the busy airport rely on copper wires and technology dating back to the 1970s. Duffy says the Federal Aviation Administration will immediately replace those old wires with modern fiber optic cables. But he warns much more needs to be done.
This system is so old that even if you have high-speed fiber information coming in to a tower, the information has to be slowed down. It comes in too fast.
The Trump administration is planning to invest billions to replace air traffic control systems across the country. Duffy says Newark will be the first to receive upgrades if the plan is funded by Congress. For NPR News, I'm Ramzi Khalife in New York.
Stocks rallied sharply on Wall Street today after word of a U.S.-China pause in the two countries' ongoing trade tiff. All three of the major indexes were up more than 2%. The Dow closed up more than 1,100 points. The Nasdaq rose 779 points. This is NPR. Some level of calm in the ongoing fighting between India and Pakistan, though Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi has said her country has only paused its military action and says it will retaliate on its own terms in the event there are further attacks on the country. India and Pakistan paused fighting over the weekend in a U.S.-brokered ceasefire. Hostilities between the two nuclear-armed rivals have been ongoing since a deadly attack on Indian tourists in Kashmir last month. India blames Pakistan. Pakistan denies the charges. A new study estimates nearly one in four children in the U.S. has at least one parent with a substance use disorder, and alcohol is the most commonly used substance among parents. Bears Ritu Chatterjee has more.
The new study used the latest data from the household-based National Survey on Drug Use and Health and found that nearly 19 million U.S. kids have a parent with a substance use disorder. Study author Sean McCabe directs the Center for the Study of Drugs, Alcohol, Smoking, and Health at the University of Michigan.
It makes you realize that the scope of this issue is vast.
McCabe says a significant proportion of those children, 7.6 million, have a parent whose addiction is severe or moderate as opposed to mild. The findings are published in the latest JAMA Pediatrics. Ritu Chatterjee, NPR News.
Former NBA star Michael Jordan is joining NBC as a special contributor to the network's coverage of the 2025-26 basketball season. NBC made the announcement this morning during a presentation at Radio City Music Hall. NBC returns to carrying NBA games after a 23-year absence. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Total Wine & More. For discovering something new this summer, like a Chardonnay, sparkling wine, or tequila, learn more at TotalWine.com. Spirits not sold in Virginia and North Carolina. Available to adults 21 or older.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. The U.S. and China are scaling back their trade war, at least for now. The two countries agreed to sharply reduce triple-digit tariffs, which had brought mother trading to a halt. The 90-day deal sparked a relief rally in the stock market. The Dow Jones Industrial Average soared more than 1,000 points. Importers are scrambling to ramp up production and get cargo loaded onto ships before this short-term tariff relief runs out. NPR's Scott Horsley joins us now. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Elsa.
Okay, so it seems fair to say that these triple-digit tariffs were not popular at all, and that's why Wall Street is reacting the way it did today, yeah?
Right. The celebration among investors shows just how costly the trade war has been and how relieved people are to see at least a temporary break from those crippling import taxes. For at least 9 days, the U.S. will drop its tariffs on Chinese imports from 145% down to 30%. China will make a similar cut to its tariffs on U.S. goods. Jay Foreman's company makes Tinker Toys and Lincoln Logs, among other playthings in China. He got a text message about the deal at 4:30 this morning.
I immediately woke up and I called my office in Hong Kong and our factories start to schedule shipments immediately. So we've been holding everything at the factories and at the ports because we didn't want to really risk putting anything on containers with 145% tariff.
Even the lower 30% tariff is hard to swallow, Foreman says. I mean, keep in mind, a few months ago, the tariff on Chinese toys was zero. But at least 30% is manageable. Foreman compared it to drinking something that's spoiled, as opposed to drinking poison, which the 145% tariffs would have been. A lot of importers feel the same way, and that's why cargo traffic really slowed in recent weeks. Now we could see a big rebound as businesses hustle to get products into the U.S.
Well, what do you think that rebound will look like?
It could be a real scramble. I talked to Bonnie Ross, who imports clothing for discount chains like Burlington. When the sky-high tariffs were announced last month, she actually pulled two containers off of a ship, and they've been sitting at a factory in China all this time. When Ross heard about the 90-day reduction in tariffs this morning, she went right to work trying to get that merchandise and maybe more to the U.S.
It was a great relief for about 5 minutes, and then my negative Nancy mind goes to, oh, no, now what?
Because keep in mind, there's a whole lot of importers now in that very same crowded boat.
Yeah.
And they're all going to be racing to get cargo to the U.S. before this three-month deal expires. We could see a jump in shipping rates as a result. Last week, the Port of Los Angeles said it was handling a third less containers than usual. The port could get a lot busier in the next few months as we get ready for the back to school shopping season, and then, of course, the Christmas holidays.
Wait, but then what? Like, what happens exactly at the end of 90 days?
Well, good question. Maybe the U.S. and China agree to leave the lower tariffs in place. Maybe the talks break down and tariffs ratchet up again. Or maybe there's a more wide-ranging agreement and we're left with a tariff that's even lower. So the cloud of uncertainty is still hanging overhead, and that's something importers like Jay Foreman have to wrestle with.
Right now, I'm just trying to get through the next probably 4 to 6 weeks, whether I double shift the factories to try to get more produced and out the door. I'll probably need another 3 or 4 weeks to figure that out.
Forecasters at the Yale Budget Lab say even with the temporary reduction in tariffs, the U.S. is still looking at higher inflation and slower economic growth than it was before the trade war began. Ironically, though, the lower tariff actually brings in more money for the government. That's because more businesses will grit their teeth and pay this tax, whereas the higher levy just brought commerce to a standstill.
That is NPR's Scott Horsley. Thank you so much, Scott.
You're welcome.
As President Trump tries to end the war in Ukraine, there is another country in the region doing all it can to prevent another Russian invasion. Poland shares a 500-mile border with Russia and Russian-ally Belarus, and Poland is going beyond building up defenses. Earlier this year, Prime Minister Donald Tusk called on all Polish men to begin military training. The Prime Minister told Poland's parliament in March that by the end of this year, every adult male in the country should be trained for war. NPR's Rob Schmitz reports.
A military band marches in front of an unwavering row of Poland's newest soldiers. Dozens of men and women who have answered the call to volunteer to protect their country against Russia. Watching from the sidelines at this ceremony outside of Warsaw is Anita Milewski, whose partner Dominik is about to take his oath to protect and serve.
No, jak? Dużo.
How do I feel? Asks Milewski nervously, glancing at her child who's holding her hand. Joy, right? We're proud of him. This is a courageous step, she says. That as she fumbles for the right thing to say, tears well up in her eyes.
Męstwa, żołnierstwa, bycia oddanym, bycia służbistą.
I'm emotional, she says, and a little nervous. We live in difficult times, and I feel like more difficult times are coming. There's a need, she says, for courageous people, tough people, and our Dominik is a rock. He's unbreakable. Dominik takes his oath and the national anthem. Behind them stand a row of 4 Abrams tanks. After the ceremony, Dominik glances longingly at them. The past month of basic training was intense, he says. We barely had time to rest. Now I'm staying on for specialized training. It's my dream to drive one of those tanks someday. These soldiers, these tanks, they're all part of Poland's overhaul of its military. This year, the country will spend nearly 5% of its GDP on defense, more than any other NATO member, including the U.S. As a neighbor of Ukraine's and host to more than 2 million of its war refugees, Poland has seen, heard, and felt what Russia is capable of, and it's now preparing for the worst. Hundreds of miles north of the capital, along Poland's border with Russia, bulldozers clear farmland for a landmine field, while crews place neat rows of concrete anti-tankers called hedgehogs that look like massive gray Lego pieces. On a work break, Polish Lieutenant Iwona Misiac gives me a tour of Poland's newly fortified border with the Russian exclave of Kaliningrad. We peer into a ditch with water. And beyond that stand rows of hedgehogs that follow the curved border for as far as the eye can see. On the other side of the ditch, beyond a fence made of razor wire, dense birch forest, Russia. We've learned from Ukraine's experience with Russia's invasion, and we've applied those lessons here, she says. These hedgehogs are here so that our enemy may break before he even thinks of biting us. And here, she says, pointing to a strip of land as wide as a football field, is a space for a minefield. Poland recently announced it was withdrawing from the Ottawa Convention, an international treaty banning the use of landmines. What we're seeing here, says Jarz, is what much of the 500-mile-long border between us and Belarus will someday look like, a very long ditch, columns of concrete hedgehogs and landmine fields. This, she says, is going to be a lot of work. Poland has set aside more than $2 billion to build this, and its treasury is buying up land from farmers along the border for this new initiative. But all the action that's happening along this tense border. Hundreds of miles east, along another stretch of the same border, U.S. soldiers conduct training exercises.
We have developed a strategy to counter any kind of mass land invasion or incursion that would occur.
Lieutenant Colonel William Branch is commander of the Forward Land Forces Multinational, a group of 1,000 U.S. soldiers at the Mamowo-Piski training area in northeastern Poland. His troops help defend NATO's eastern front along a stretch of a gap. A corridor where military strategists say Russia would likely target if it were to attack NATO member states. Branch's soldiers have made visits to the nearby Baltic states of Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia. And along with Poland, he says,
there's a persistent theme in all of those visits. These countries are actively fighting to retain their sovereignty, fighting to continue to exist because there is a real threat that exists.
And while there is a real threat, agrees Mariusz Marszałkowski, publisher of Defense 24, a Warsaw-based security magazine, he says Russia's European neighbors have had time to prepare, drawing on years' worth of lessons from Ukraine to study how Russia wages war.
My byliśmy przyzwyczajeni patrząc po...
America is accustomed to quick aerial wars, he says, but Russia has retained its arsenal from days. And that means, he says, low-tech, land-based warfare is what Poland is focusing on defending itself against. But Marszałkowski says the challenge now is figuring out President Donald Trump. Would the U.S. defend Poland if Russia attacked? He says Poland's government has handled this question in vague diplomatic terms. But its actions, he says, show that it's beginning to look elsewhere for help. The Polish government, he says, sees hope in France, which has an extensive nuclear arsenal, and the terms under which it can use these weapons are different from Britain's, which require American consent before they deploy them. So from a security perspective, he says, France is a safer option from where to seek assistance. In the next few months, he says, Poland and France will sign big strategic agreements of security cooperation that may include Poland's purchase of French air tankers, submarines, and weaponry, and may also include an agreement that Poland will now be inside France's protective nuclear umbrella. An agreement, he says, that could be as important as defense barriers along Poland's borders or a buildup of Poland's military. Anything, he says, to stop Russia. Rob Schmitz, NPR News. Poland.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Thank you.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Raymond James, a firm focused on transforming lives, businesses, and communities through tailored wealth management, banking, and capital market solutions. Disclosures at RaymondJames.com. And from Subaru, the new Forester Hybrid offers symmetrical all-wheel drive and up to 581 miles per tank, part of the new Forester Hybrid family of SUVs. More at Subaru.com/ForesterHybrid. This is NPR.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Ailsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. Last year, thousands of people protesting Israel's war in Gaza were arrested on U.S. college campuses, but many had their charges dropped. Last week in Michigan, the cases against seven protesters were dismissed, closing a chapter for them. Michigan Public's Beenish Ahmed reports.
It was still dark when dozens of police officers in face shields began to move toward a large group of protesters at the University of Michigan last May. University officials said the tent encampment on a public square posed a fire hazard, so police were there to remove it. Police used batons and pepper spray to push protesters back. Most of them complied, eventually. Authorities charged seven with resisting arrest, a felony in Michigan, for allegedly putting objects like tables and bikes between them and police, or pushing up against officers with their bodies. The state attorney general, Dana Nessel, stepped in to bring those charges. Last month, defense attorneys tried to get Nessel to recuse herself. They argued that she took a case that typically would have been handled on a local level. Defense attorneys also said she was biased against the protesters because she called a Palestinian rallying cry, "From the river to the sea, Palestine will be free," anti-Semitic. Nessel, in a statement, called allegations of bias, quote, baseless and absurd. She said she stood by her charging decisions, but dismissed the cases because she said they were no longer a good use of her department's resources. Defense attorney Amir Mokhled said the dismissal was a victory.
And today the state of Michigan agrees that you still have the right to speak up.
According to Harvard researchers, around 4,000 pro-Palestinian protesters were arrested on college campuses between October 2023 and the end of last year. At least a few dozen protesters have been charged with felonies across the U.S. In many of those cases, authorities allege activists got violent. They fought back against police or caused serious property damage. But many of the protesters' charges have been dropped or dismissed. Ziella Shamas is with the left-leaning Center for Constitutional Rights. She says that shows protesters' actions were, by and large, lawful.
There wasn't any basis for the charges, and that these people should have never been arrested in the first place, and that they were part of these sweeps to clamp down on the campuses.
Last week, pro-Palestinian protesters again took to college campuses, including at Columbia, where police arrested about 80 people who occupied a building on Wednesday. In Michigan, protesters whose charges were dismissed were defiant. Activist Sammy Lewis stood alongside other defendants outside of the courthouse last week.
When we don't cower to repression, this is what happens. We win.
But with a new wave of protests and arrests erupting on college campuses, the fight might not be over yet. For NPR News, I'm Beenish Ahmed in Ann Arbor, Michigan.
Starting even before the COVID-19 pandemic, Americans have been volunteering less and less frequently. That is the finding of the Do Good Institute at the University of Maryland. And well, here at All Things Considered, we wanted to devote some time this year to exploring who does volunteer in the U.S., why do they do it, and how does that volunteering make them feel? Here to help us launch this series, which we are calling Here to Help, is Nathan Dietz. He's the research director of the Do Good Institute, which I just mentioned. Welcome to All Things Considered, Nathan.
Thank you, Ailsa.
So to start us off, can we just first define some terms here, just very broadly? What do we mean when we say volunteerism? How would you characterize that?
Well, volunteerism, I think, is a term that refers to all work that people do that isn't paid on behalf of others. Actually, doing it on behalf of others isn't necessarily part of the definition, but that is what most people think of when they think of volunteering.
Yeah.
Now, The particular type of volunteering that we have studied most of all, many people call formal volunteering, which is volunteering that's done through or for an organization.
Okay. So you're not like tracking someone volunteering to mow their neighbor's lawn.
That's exactly right. That's an example of what we might call informal volunteering.
And how many Americans roughly participate in formal volunteerism?
The percentage of people who have volunteered ages 16 and over has usually been between 25% and 30%. And sometimes it's been as low as the low 20s, but it's never been a very high percentage.
It's so funny when you said that 30% has never been really a high percentage. When you first said that statistic, I thought, well, that's higher than I thought. That's pretty high. That's pretty good. That's how jaded I am about people's willingness to volunteer for anything these days. And can you tell me, when did you start tracking this data? How many years ago?
It was tracked before this on an off and on basis, but it was collected on an annual basis starting in 2002. And that was done in response to the September 11th attacks. Then President Bush issued a call to service to all Americans to get more involved in your communities in response to these tragedies.
What are some of the hardest barriers to overcome when it comes to trying to encourage more volunteering?
Trying to make a range of volunteering opportunities available to people who might not be able to volunteer in the traditional way.
I mean, thinking about this from an individual level, and maybe I'm just projecting myself into this, I think a big barrier is people just assume they don't have the time.
Well, if you look at a typical day for volunteers versus non-volunteers, volunteers, their day looks pretty much like non-volunteers' day does, except that volunteers sleep less and they watch less TV. Simple as that.
What happens if I like to sleep and watch TV? What do I do, Nathan?
Well, neither of those things makes you a bad person.
Well, as we roll out this series, Nathan, we hope that our listeners will share their own volunteer stories. And I'm just wondering, have you ever volunteered? My guess is yes. And if so, is there a story about your own volunteering that you want to share with us?
Throughout my life, you know, I've done volunteer work for this or that reason. I'll tell you, though, I think thinking back, the experience that I remember most closely, and this is from as far back as I can remember, my mom was always very interested in having other kids in the community around to do things together. You know, kids from the neighborhood would all sort of congregate over at our house and, play with me and my mom. You know, there were periods where I thought to myself, oh, this isn't fair. These kids have parents. Why are they bothering me and my mom? Yeah. But
you were volunteering, Nathan.
Well, part of what motivates volunteering for people is that there's benefit. It feels great to kind of open up your social circles to include people who aren't from your immediate family and closest friends.
Yeah.
And that's what my mom was doing. That is, one of the most fantastic lessons I think that anybody could have.
Nathan Dietz is the research director at the Do Good Institute. Thank you so much for this conversation. I really enjoyed talking to you.
Oh, same here, Elsa. Thanks a lot.
And we want your help. Tell us your own story about how being a volunteer has shaped your life, or nominate someone you think we should profile. Go to npr.org and search Here to Help.
This is NPR News.
The U.S. backed off its trade war with China for 90 days.
After productive talks in Geneva, both sides now agreed to reduce the tariffs imposed.
The U.S. and China reset tariffs almost back to where they were before President Trump's Liberation Day. So what did the U.S. gain from weeks of chaos? On the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
That's All Things Considered. From NPR News, I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. Coming up, a new documentary about Marcella Hazan, who brought Italian cooking to so many Americans.
That was really one of my mother's gifts, to be able to put very few ingredients together and make something extraordinary.
First, this news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Duane Brown. The U.S. and China agreed to a temporary break from their triple-digit tariffs war after talks in Switzerland over the weekend. President Trump, speaking from the Oval Office, says negotiations with Beijing will continue during a 90-day pause on most tariffs.
Yesterday, we achieved a total reset with China. After productive talks in Geneva, both sides now agreed to reduce the tariffs imposed after April 2nd to 10% for 90 days as negotiators continue on the larger structural issues.
In exchange, China is temporarily cutting its tax on imports from the U.S. to just 10%. It's short-term relief for many U.S. businesses that rely on Chinese imports. The remaining tariffs, however, are still significantly higher than Americans are used to paying, and uncertainty remains over what happens in 3 months when the deal expires. Harvard is pushing back on the Trump administration, saying federal intervention on campus issues may be doing more harm than good. NPR's Winder Johnston reports the Department of Education is currently investigating the school.
Harvard University President Alan Garber says the school shares some goals with the Trump administration, like fighting anti-Semitism and encouraging diverse viewpoints. But in a letter to the Department of Education, Garber warns that heavy-handed federal involvement is actually hurting those efforts. Garber says the university is committed to addressing hate and protecting free expression, but he says it must be allowed to do so independently. Harvard has been under increasing pressure since pro-Palestinian demonstrations erupted on campus following the start of the war in Gaza. The White House has accused the university of failing to protect Jewish students and allowing anti-Semitism to spread. Windsor Johnston, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR. Negotiators from states that use the Colorado River are skipping a public hearing amid tense talks about sharing the water supply for 40 million people. Alex Hager of member station KUNC reports.
The seven policymakers working on an agreement to divide the shrinking Colorado River usually meet behind closed doors. An upcoming conference in Boulder, Colorado is a rare opportunity for them to all appear together on a public stage. But now they've told organizers they'll skip it. John Fleck teaches water policy at the University of New Mexico.
The unwillingness to answer the public's questions both suggests that negotiations aren't going well, but I think it misses an important obligation in democratic governance of a river that serves 40 million people.
Negotiators are quickly approaching a 2026 deadline to come up with new rules to split up water between farms, tribes, and major cities like Denver, Phoenix, and Los Angeles. For NPR News, I'm Alex Hager in Fort Collins, Colorado.
A Biden-era junk fee rule takes effect today, requiring ticket sellers, hotels, and other companies to disclose processing fees and other charges up front to consumers. The new rule comes in response to numerous complaints about Ticketmaster's hidden fees for concerts and other events. For its part, Ticketmaster says it will start displaying the full price of a ticket as soon as consumers begin shopping online. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from CFP, Certified Financial Planner Professionals, committed to acting in their clients' best interests. Learn more at letsmakeaplan.org. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Juana Summers in Washington. House Republicans are filling in the details this week for the major components of the so-called Big Beautiful Bill that contains President Trump's tax, immigration, and energy agenda. The president spoke about the bill earlier today.
I was just telling the leader and the speaker that it's going to be very hard for the Democrats to vote against the one big, beautiful deal. The greatest tax cuts in history, greatest everything.
But splits among Republicans on things like changes to Medicaid and tax cuts could be the real hurdle to getting this bill through the House this month. NPR congressional correspondent Deirdre Walsh joins us now from the Capitol. Hey there.
Hey, Juana.
So, Deirdre, Republicans proposed some changes to Medicaid, which is the health care program for low-income, elderly, and disabled people, in order to get a big chunk of savings. Help us understand what they want to do.
Right. Republicans are relying on these changes to Medicaid to help reach their target in this bill of cutting $1.5 trillion to pay for their tax cuts. The Congressional Budget Office estimated that the changes in the draft now would cut $715 billion over 10 years from Medicaid and the Affordable Care Act, and at least 8.6 million people would lose their health care coverage in the next decade. In terms of the proposals, the Republican plan adds work requirements for able-bodied adults enrolled in Medicaid who don't have any dependents. It also adds some new co-payments for some people. It freezes taxes that states impose on Medicaid providers. Those taxes help states boost how much federal money they get for Medicaid. Republicans also say their plan will cut waste, fraud, and abuse. They do this by verifying income and residency for people in the program, changing how people enroll. But under pressure from swing district Republicans, leaders did not include major Medicaid reforms that would have shifted big costs to the states.
Interesting. So Republicans, are they all on the same page about this?
They're not. I mean, not all Republicans think that they should be doing these major changes to Medicaid. One of them, Missouri Republican Senator Josh Hawley, wrote an editorial in the New York Times today criticizing some in his party who he says want to slash health care for the working poor. He called that move, quote, both morally wrong and politically suicidal.
Huh. Now, a centerpiece of this package is renewing the tax cuts that President Trump enacted in his first term in 2017. Is that still the plan?
It is. Those 2017 tax cuts expire at the end of this year, and the Republican bill would permanently extend them. That would cost $5 trillion over the next decade, according to CBO. The Republican plan also increases the standard tax deduction for individuals and married couples for the next 4 years. It also increases the size of the child tax credit. That's something that both parties support. This bill also creates something new called MAGA accounts, essentially government savings accounts for young people to use for school or businesses in the future, providing that people can contribute up to $5,000 into those accounts a year.
I understand, though, some tax issues still have not been finalized. Tell us what they are.
Right. There's still a big fight inside the Republican Party over a tax deduction for state and local taxes. Republicans who represent districts with high property taxes in places like New York, New Jersey, California, say that cap needs to be lifted. That's really expensive to do, and conservatives push to reduce the deficit. They don't want to do that. So this draft bill does increase the amount people can deduct, but it's unclear what's going to end up in the final version of this bill.
So walk us through the plan for moving this bill through Congress.
House Speaker Mike Johnson still wants to get the House to vote on a final bill that they come up with before Memorial Day recess. Remember, he's really slim margin in the House, and he can only afford to lose 3 votes to get this through. Conservatives are still pushing for larger spending cuts, as much as $2 trillion. But the real deadline for the House and the Senate to get a final bill to the president's desk is mid-July. That's when Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent says the country is going to run out of revenue to pay its bills. And in this bill, Republicans plan to increase the country's borrowing authority for the next 5 years.
NPR's Deirdre Walsh, thank you.
Thanks, Juana.
The president is taking aim once again at prescription drug prices. He signed a new executive order today that he says will mean Americans will not subsidize drug development for the rest of the world through high U.S. prices. NPR Pharmaceuticals correspondent Sydney Lupkin is here to break it down for us. Hi, Sydney.
Hi.
Okay, so walk us through what the president says he's trying to do here exactly.
So he's taking aim at the fact that Americans generally pay a lot more for prescription drugs than other developed countries. And that's something both parties can agree on. Okay. Merck's cancer drug Keytruda costs more than $100,000 more in the United States than in Germany, for instance. And that's according to a recent Senate committee report authored by Democrats. So today's executive order is geared toward lowering prices paid in the U.S. to make them more in line with what people pay in these other countries. And it's called most favored nation pricing. Here's President Trump talking about it at the White House this morning.
Whoever is paying the lowest price, we will look at that price and we will say that's the price we're going to pay.
Trump also wants to see other countries pay more, and he seemed to be pushing drug companies to advance that cause. But other countries typically have government health care systems that set prices that they're willing to pay. So why would they change? The United States, by and large, doesn't set prices, so drug companies have more freedom to set prices with what the market will bear.
Okay, well then, what does this executive order entail exactly?
It has several parts. It directs the administration to come up with target prices and share them with the industry within 30 days. If companies don't voluntarily comply, the order lays out steps the administration could take to force those lower prices, including by making administrative rules, for example. The executive order also directs the Health and Human Services Secretary to facilitate direct-to-consumer drug sales, bypassing health insurance at lower prices. Meanwhile, it also directs the U.S. Trade Representative and Department of Commerce to take action against, quote, unreasonable and discriminatory policies that lower drug prices outside the U.S. So the order is pretty broad and a lot is happening at once.
Yeah. Okay. Does the administration even have the authority to do all of these things?
So rulemaking to implement existing laws is something the administration can and does do fairly routinely. But there's a lot this executive order that's still hazy. It's not clear from this order which drugs the administration would target. Trump seemed to want to go after obesity drugs during the press conference. It's also not clear which countries' prices could be used for comparison. And of course, there's a big question around how the Trump administration can push drug makers to get other countries to pay more. Juliet Kubansky, a Medicare drug pricing expert at the nonpartisan research group KFF, says she has a lot more questions than answers right now. It could be really good for patients and payers, she says.
But I think the question really is in the details of how this gets implemented.
Right. And what has the drug industry said about all of this?
So when Trump teased this executive order Sunday on Truth Social, the drug industry trade group Pharma came out against it. The CEO for the group called it a bad deal for American patients. Today, after the executive order was signed, he released another statement. It said Americans shouldn't have to foot the bill for global innovation. And to lower cost, America is right to push other countries to pay their fair share through trade negotiations. Though I should say trade negotiations aren't explicitly part of the order, but there's a lot of details to be fleshed out.
Truly. That was NPR Pharmaceuticals correspondent Sydney Lupkin. Thank you, Sydney.
You bet.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. When it comes to carbohydrates, dietitians have some pretty standard advice. Whole grains like brown rice and whole wheat are better than refined grains like white rice and pasta. Well, it turns out there is a way to make those refined grains healthier. Michaeline Duclef reports on a superfood hidden in cold pasta salad and leftover rice.
Mindy Patterson is a nutritionist at Texas Women's University in Houston. She says that pasta and white rice are a bit, well, naughty.
Well, they're in a sense naughty because they are rapidly digested typically. So therefore, it creates a rise in blood sugar, and that happens pretty fast.
That quick rise in blood sugar isn't great for your health, especially if you have diabetes. Patterson says that over time, it can trigger inflammation, contribute to insulin resistance, and it just makes you feel tired.
If we don't have these spikes and dips in our blood sugar, then we tend to have more energy and just feeling better about ourselves, right? Healthier.
Whole grains, on the other hand, don't cause such high spikes in blood sugar because we digest their carbohydrates much more slowly. But in the past decade, scientists have figured out a way to make white rice and pasta less naughty to help us digest it more slowly. The trick?
If you put it in the refrigerator and cool it down, it contributes less sugar that can go to the blood.
That's right. If you take a hot plate of pasta or a steaming bowl of rice and chill it for 6 or 8 hours or even overnight, then when you eat the cold grains, your blood sugar won't spike as high. So in a way, cold pasta or leftover rice is healthier for you than their freshly cooked versions?
Yes, for sure.
And this trick also works for whole grains and beans too, making those superfoods even healthier. If you're wondering how this works, Maria Marco, a microbiologist at UC Davis, can help explain it. She says that as the pasta or rice sits in the refrigerator, some of its carbohydrates tangle up and stick together.
They're just twisted shapes or different branches, and what that means is that our enzymes can't reach it.
We can't break down the long chains of carbohydrates into simple sugars, so we can't digest them. Now, if you think about it carefully, scientists have a particular name for a carbohydrate that we can't digest, fiber.
This one kind of fiber.
And it's a special one. It's called resistant starch. Ravinder Nagpal is a gut microbiologist at Florida State University. He says that resistant starch is linked with a whole host of benefits. It reduces inflammation and helps you manage your blood sugar. It also helps improve your gut health because it feeds the trillions of microbes in your lower intestine.
Yes, our microbiome thrives on fiber and resistant starches.
Now, if you don't like the sound of eating cold rice or pasta, Nagpal says you can reheat it, but do it gently. Don't overdo it. Reheat it quickly in the microwave or
fry it lightly with some of your favorite veggies.
Otherwise, you'll lose this super fiber and its health benefits. For NPR News, I'm Maiklin Duclef.
All Things Considered from NPR News. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. In these times of turbulence, of uncertainty, how about this for comfort food? The perfect roast chicken. Just four ingredients, the chicken, two lemons, salt, pepper. The recipe basically is season the chicken, stuff the lemons inside, cook it. And that is Marcella Hazan's classic, iconic roast chicken with lemons. Watching one crisp up is one of the many pleasures in the new documentary about Hazan's life and cooking, which is titled simply Marcella.
You know, for my mother, it was, I don't know if I would say taken for granted, but, you know, it was normal. This is what you ate.
Well, her son, Giuliano Hazan, is in the film and joins me now to talk about it. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Is that chicken really as good as it looks? Because it looks amazing.
The chicken is magical. That's really how I would describe it. As you said, there's very few ingredients, but that was really one of my mother's gifts, to be able to put very few ingredients together and make something extraordinary.
So let's start at the beginning, as the film does. It tells the story of your mother's improbable path to becoming a famous chef. And I say improbable for a couple of reasons. One was, and I never knew this, a childhood accident had left her with a broken right arm that never fully healed. Incredibly challenging for a chef who needs to use their hands in the kitchen. How did she learn to work around it?
My mother was determined to be able to do anything and everything. And so she was not going to let having a lame arm stop her from anything. She was born right-handed, but after this accident, she had to learn how to write left-handed. And so also when she started cooking, she figured out how to do things with, as she put it, one and a half arms instead of two.
The other reason I say it was improbable that she ended up this world famous chef is that she trained not to be a chef, but to be a scientist. She had dual degrees. She didn't learn to cook until she married your dad and moved from Italy to New York City in the 1950s.
That is correct. Yes. I mean, she used to be perfectly happy with a mortadella sandwich, you know, for a meal.
as are we all.
Yes. I mean, there's nothing wrong with one. But my father wanted more. She used to say that my father could put up with a lot of things, but not a bad meal. And so she started, you know, teaching herself how to cook. And I think she discovered early on that she really had an intuition for it. It was buried within her, I guess. My grandmother used to be a very good cook. And so she started being able to put flavors together in a wonderful way. And flavor was really what was most important to my mother.
What was for dinner when you were a little kid?
Oh, it was so many different things. I mean, I have a weakness for pasta, so whenever she would cook a pasta dish, I was always happy.
Were you something of a guinea pig? Like, if we'll see if Giuliano likes it, and then I'll roll it out for everybody else.
Actually, she used to call me her official taster.
Wow.
Because she actually didn't like to taste. She would always smell what she was cooking to see whether it needed salt or needed something else.
Yeah, there's a scene in the movie where she's not tasting anything. A pot is bubbling away. She sniffs it and says, needs more salt. And I'm thinking, how can you tell that just from smelling it? But she could?
Yes. No, absolutely. Absolutely. But when she wanted more information, she would say, official taster, come here. And I'd come and taste.
How old were you when she started teaching you?
I was young. I don't remember exactly how old, but ever since I was maybe 6 or 7, I think I liked to watch her while she was cooking in the kitchen. There was a stool I sat on. And, you know, little by little, she would start to let me do some things. I think one of the first things I did was stir the risotto. And I really only started cooking in earnest when I left home, mostly because I was hungry. I missed the food I was used to.
So she learned to cook, as we've described, as a matter of necessity. Your dad was hungry, you were hungry. And it turns out she was really good at it. So her story is she started teaching cooking classes, and then she got a call one day, hey, what if you wrote a cookbook? Which I gather was a challenge because her English was a lifelong work in progress. Your father, Victor, had to step in there?
Yes. My mother, you know, when she first moved to the States, didn't speak a word of English. But she started learning how to speak. But writing was a different thing. And she said, you know, there's no way that I can write a cookbook in English. But my father said, well, you know, what if I translated it for you? And so they began this working partnership where my mother would write the recipes and then my father would look at them and would ask her some questions to clarify things. And then he would sit at the typewriter and type them out.
I gather quantity was also an issue. She didn't like to measure.
No, I don't either.
Which is
actually
a challenge when you're writing a cookbook. Like, throw the right amount in is not going to cut it for the rest of us.
Exactly. So she, you know, she would first practice making a dish until she was happy with the way it came out. And then she would make it again and measure everything. And sometimes my father would come to the rescue and you know, catch something that she was putting in a measuring cup or something like that. And
like she would say, I'm just going to throw in the right amount, and your dad would have to catch it and figure out how much that was for the cookbooks?
Yes, exactly.
Do you know if she had a favorite dish, a meal that if she was cooking, I don't know, just for herself or just for you and her dad, this was the go-to?
So if you asked her that, she would look at you and say, that's a media question. She, you know, it depended on what she saw at the market that inspired her. What was good that day and what got her mouth watering. And the next day might be something different.
Well, I'm guilty as charged of asking the media question, and that's the perfect answer. Whatever's in the market, that's what's for dinner. Giuliano Hazan, I want to thank you for talking with us, and I will share my grand plan for this coming weekend. It's going to be buying a couple of lemons and a chicken and paying tribute to your mom, cooking her famous roast chicken. Thank you.
Wonderful. Buon appetito.
Grazie. Giuliano Hazan, talking about the new documentary about his mother, Marcella.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org. From Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, which monitors safe driving habits to determine a personalized rate, at progressive.com. Not available in California or from all agents. From Cunard, offering travelers an opportunity to voyage aboard Cunard's Queen Elizabeth to Alaska. Guests can experience Glacier Bay National Park and Hubbard Glacier, as well as locally sourced cuisine. Learn more at Cunard.